Hi, my name is Jo Harkin, and my new book is titled The Pretender.
Author Jo Harkin was taking a break from writing her science fiction novel by reading a book about kings and queens. That's when she came across the name Lambert Simnel in the footnotes of British history. Simnel was a known pretender to Henry VII's throne, but not much is known about him. It's 5 years later, and Harkin didn't go back to the sci-fi work, but instead is releasing her novel, The Pretender, in which she imagines Simnel's life as a pretender, filling in with fiction what written history might have left out. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Jo Harkin. I should probably begin with an admission, because there's so much about history that I do not know. I had no idea when I started reading this that The Pretender is based on historical events. Can you give our listeners a brief description of The Pretender?
Absolutely. I actually hadn't heard of The Pretender, whose name is Lambert Simnel in real life, myself. And I don't think many people in England have, even though it's our history. He's really just a small footnote in the reign of Henry VII, who's kind of an overlooked king compared to his really charismatic son, Henry VIII, and his granddaughter, Elizabeth I. So I stumbled upon Lambert Simnel completely by chance. I was reading a book about English history, basically as procrastination. I was meant to be writing a sci-fi novel and researching that. And somewhere in like a journal about the molecular formation of memory, I began to get a bit bored, and I sort of turned to this book about the kings and queens. And yeah, this is where I came across Lambert. And I didn't really know much about this period, obviously didn't know anything about him. And he was basically a boy who, when he was very young, was put at the forefront of a campaign to unseat Henry VII, who was then a new king, and take back the throne for the Yorks. He was purporting to be the last York heir, the Earl of Warwick. It's unlikely that he was. And after his attempt failed, he disappeared back into obscurity. Nobody knows what happened to him, and nobody knows where he came from. And that just really intrigued me as a writer, both the craziness of his life and also these huge blank spaces that I kind of wondered, maybe I could create something for him here.
This wasn't the only pretender at the time, is that right?
Yeah, Lambert was not the only pretender. There was a more famous pretender called Perkin Warbeck later on. He's a bit more well documented. I think there's more sort of fictional explorations of him. But probably for that reason, he appealed to me less, because we do know a bit more about him and we know how his life ended badly, as it turned out. He was executed. But yeah, so it's a really interesting period of history because it really hasn't received that much attention.
You mentioned documentation. And in this book, Edward or Lambert or Simnel, this person comes to the realization about who writes history and what history survives based on who's writing that history. Can you talk about the history that exists and your research into it?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a funny period in terms of documentation. It was quite patchy. So the longer history goes on, the more information piles up, to the point where I guess someone researching our age now, sort of a few hundred years down the line, would absolutely struggle to plow through it all. But back then, there really was very little primary source material. So we've got the Parliament rolls, and we've actually got Simnel's confession, which was probably written for him. And then we've got the chronicles of the time, the historians who were basically, they went with whatever the party line was. So whatever king was in power, they would write things that didn't annoy those kings. So, and it's in those chronicles that we find Simnel. He just gets a little bit of a mention. He wasn't dwelt on because obviously he was a threat to the throne, so they weren't going to go into too much detail or legitimize him by doing so. So yeah, there was actually just so little there when I looked. I found a lot about the period, but very little about the actual events.
So holes in history allow for imagination to take hold, you know, in the fictionalization and reimagining of that history. How do you determine what to incorporate from quote unquote history and what to make up yourself?
So I kind of took a lead from Hilary Mantel, who I think is a great person to take a lead from in most ways. So If there was something that seemed like it was legitimately historical fact and not propaganda or wild claims or rumors, which you do get in sort of some of the chronicles, some of it was just hearsay. Where it seemed solid, I would treat that as concrete. So, yeah, I didn't want to change it. I didn't want to write an alternate history. But then where there was a blank space, I would feel free to create something. So, and a lot of the personalities of the era were up for grabs in that way. You know, we know what the people did. We know sort of the facts of their births, their deaths, but we don't, in turn, unless it's a huge name like a king, you don't know so much about their motivations or their characters, and so that was really interesting to explore.
The Pretender in your book begins under the name John, and then becomes Lambert, and then Simnel, and then Edward, and then Lambert Simnel, and so on. And the different identities were meant to protect him. But with each name change, I wonder if the person changed as well. I mean, we were able to see this young man grow, both, in body and in intellect. But I'm wondering, is there power in a name?
I think for Lambert, absolutely. Each shift in his identity, some of which are chosen for him and some of which he chooses himself, without getting into spoiler territory, I think with each one, it does sort of herald a change in him. Because also at the time, who you were and where you were kind of considered to sit in society was absolutely critical to your identity. So the name would have meant a lot to him personally. And his lack of control over his name in the early stages, I think is, yeah, that was an interesting way into his character. And then later on, when he's kind of puzzling over who and what he is, he's trying to work out what his name ought to be. And again, that was, yeah, I found that really fertile ground for looking at his character and how he changes from a really innocent boy to, towards the end, quite a ruthless operator in his own right.
We saw him grow in this way that you just described, but then we saw a loss of faith. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, his loss of faith is quite comprehensive. So in the beginning, he's a sort of ebullient but also innocent and well-meaning boy. Like he believes firmly in God. He wants to do good, he wants to go to heaven, and he just accepts authority without questioning it. When two mysterious men come to his father's farm one day and tell him that he's not a peasant child, he's the secret Earl of Warwick, and now he's got to go and get the throne back, he just accepts that and believes them. And it's as the novel goes on that his faith in things darkens. He also believes any history he reads, so he just takes that as gospel. And it's only later, as he gets his education, he realizes that historians disagree, that sources differ, that people cite God but then do something else entirely. He's growing up and he's becoming more cynical. And then when around the midpoint where we approach his second act and his battle plan fails, this is when he's really just has a crisis of faith in pretty much all respects. He doesn't believe in anything anymore because everything's been taken away from him.
I did highlight this one quote, and I don't have a question about it. If you want to comment on it, feel free. And this quote that I highlighted reads, "There are so many different kinds of treachery."
Yes, I like that one. I think Knopf actually picked that one out to sort of use as in their publicity material. And yeah, I think I wanted to explore that in the novel. And I wanted there to be an ambiguity in the treachery as well, that it's not that there were heroes and villains. I mean, they're not the times now, and they certainly weren't the times then. People might betray others for what they consider to be good reasons. A lot of people betray others out of just sheer practicality because that was life. You know, it was a fight for survival, you know, at the top tier of society. So he really does experience a lot, but at the same time, I wanted the book to end or come to a note where it was hard to judge for all the treachery. It's not that you could just look at someone and say, this person is a villain. Everyone had their reasons, and by the end, he's got his reasons, and he's become somebody who betrays people himself. And I just really was interested in the nuance of getting led to this place.
I have a couple of questions about craft and even the publishing of this book. First, I want to touch on craft because as I read this book, you know, there were so many words I was introduced to that are now obsolete or different spellings of words than what we see now. And I'm imagining how difficult research must have been because I've gone to some of these, you know, 13th, 14th, 15th century writings where you know, even the alphabet they used is slightly different. The letters look completely different than what we see now. So talk to me about incorporating this style, these words into your writing. And I mean, I would imagine spell check was just no help at all to you.
Oh, yeah, no, I had to turn spell check off. The whole document was just this mess of underlinings. It was a strange time because at that point, Middle English, which is basically the kind of language that the Chaucer used, was turning into early modern English. So it was actually quite hard to get a handle on how people were really talking back then and writing. So it was hard to read as I researched. But you kind of get your eye in. So as you say, there were letters that we don't have now. But once you kind of get used to them and you've spent a bit of time, it's good to spend more time in one source and then you sort of get the flow. It is enjoyable in itself, but yeah, it was a challenge at first and slow progress. But then as I went, I was discovering all these just really amazing words that I wish we still had in use. And this book is maybe partly an attempt to kind of bring them back. So like hudder mudder for doing something secretly, brain pan for skull. Just all the many, many rude words as well that I won't say on this show because I'm assuming it's family friendly. But it was just such a delight to explore those and to kind of to sprinkle them in to give a flavor of the period without going into full Middle English myself, which I think would be a bit too much to ask of any reader.
So early in the book, there's a reference to a story of, quote unquote, an upside down fairy prince. You know, this idea behind the story is that's where John's father, Will, got his gold, or that he actually had gold. And it reminded me of the image on the cover where there are like two likenesses of the would-be King Edward. And I'm probably seeing similarities where there are none, but I do wonder if you have any say in like the cover design or in the title for that matter.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So, with the cover design, originally I think it was just one face, and we—it's a funny one with cover design. They'll always ask how you feel, but ultimately the design comes from the designers. So we had input, and I think I actually really liked the cover initially. I was quite easily pleased, and I was like, "Yes, it looks great. Love the colors." And then I think it was my UK or US agent at the time who said, I think we should kind of explore it a bit, you know, push it a bit further. And I think this is when they came up with the two faces looking at each other. And I really love that because it does reflect these two sort of identities that he's flitting between. He's, you know, on the one hand, there's this peasant child that he sort of suspects himself to be. On the other hand, there's this noble boy who he's told he really is. And never really has, you know, a certainty about that. So, and obviously you have, yeah, this look at the fairy world and how it's an inversion of our normal world, and the idea that he's, you know, child swapping, and if he's really been swapped. So I love that the cover sort of evokes that. But then at the same time, I wanted to play with this idea because the beginning is sort of a bit of a trope, I think. A child of humble origins is told that he's got this grand future and he's whisked off to begin it. And actually, John, he does have a humble beginning, but he likes his life. He likes his family. He's plagued by an angry goat on his dad's farm that he has to do battle with. But other than that, his life is nice as much as it can be. And he's taken off to a world that he actually finds quite terrifying and has a lot of fear about. And I liked that kind of change to the trope as I was writing. I wanted to sort of come at it from a different angle. So yeah, there were lots of sideways angles in the book, I hope, that are also reflected in that cover.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that you put aside your sci-fi project to work on this book, and this is your first historical fiction novel. Did you learn anything about your craft, about writing within this genre, and can it apply to your sci-fi?
I did learn so much. I kind of went slightly naively and slightly arrogantly into the writing of this one because, yeah, I had come from sci-fi and there was research involved. I really wanted the sci-fi I wrote to be grounded in actual reality and what's theoretically possible with memory, which is what the subject I was looking at there. And then going into this one, I really thought, oh, you know, this won't take me that long. It'll be about the same as a sci-fi. And this was just absolutely stupid of me because I didn't know anything about the period. I didn't know anything about Simnel. And then I set myself the huge task of really kind of trying to get a full immersion in his world, like not just the society and daily life, but also his kind of cultural reality, what he would have been reading and consuming, because I felt like that would feed into his character too. So I basically just set myself this task of getting to know the whole of the 1400s, and the run-up to it, as well as this character. And it took me about 5 years in the research and writing of it. So that was a huge learning curve. And there were points partway through that I really questioned what I was doing and why I was doing it. So yeah, in terms of whether I would take some of the things I learned in the next book, I'm not sure. I think this is it's a tricky one because I'd probably aim to write something different again, and I think I'll end up with a whole new set of challenges. I think maybe the goal as a writer is not to learn anything useful, just to throw yourself in and have a really hard time over and over again.
So, do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I think what I really love for readers to take away is something personalized, like something different for each reader. What I really wanted was not to kind of present a moral or an answer or really like a definitive, this is why this person did this, that's why that person did that. I wanted there to be room for interpretation and for people to take their own feelings about the book away. So I guess my dream would be for each person to have a different take. Yeah, that would be the goal for me.
Well, the book is The Pretender. Jo Harkin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jo Harkin, author of the book The Pretender, which was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.